Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully. You know, one of the things that seems to be showing up more and more as I look at climate mitigation is the opportunity and the necessity for approaching things with a justice framework in mind. It's just not fair that folks around the world and here at home who have had the least to do with climate change, fossil fuel emissions, are bearing the brunt of the pollution and the climate change. So today we're going to be talking to Marcus Mason. He's with Citizens for Healthy Bay, a great organization right here in Tacoma that you should check out and take a look at supporting them and their work. Marcus is a climate justice community organizer with Citizens for Healthy Bay. He lives right here in good old Tacoma, too. He's a graduate of Western Washington University. He's got a background working for Amnesty International as a student officer. He's got a background in environmental training. And I think as we talk with him today, you'll pick up on his depth of knowledge and his passion for his subject. So let's go listen in. We're really happy to have Marcus Mason with us today. He's with Citizens for Healthy Bay, one of the outstanding environmental organizations we have locally here in Tacoma. And Marcus, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, coolio. So let's jump right in. Tell us a little bit about how you developed the interest in environmental activism that I know is very much a part of your life.
Yeah, so it's actually really funny. I got my start in like what I call organizing as I know it back in college. I think it was my sophomore year, I want to say. And me and some other students were in an international, I think our class was like international studies. I can't remember what the course title was, but our teacher was like, hey, so I'm a part of Amnesty International. They were wondering if we wanted to start a student chapter. We haven't had a student chapter since the 90s. So it'd been like, you know, I think it'd been almost 30 years at that point. It was like back in 2017. And so me and some students were like, yeah, let's do it. And so we just kind of started up our own chapter of Amnesty International. We weren't even really familiar with Amnesty International because it's something kind of a lot of our parents were involved in, right? And so we kind of just jumped into it. We felt really passionate about human rights, you know, learning about all the human rights abuses and all these issues with democracy and, you know, even the things at home, right? The way we treat our folks of color and indigenous communities. So really, like, we were just really drawn to human rights. You know, it was kind of on the tail end of the second to last presidential election. I'm sure we all know who I'm talking about. And it felt like a really scary moment. And so I think we were like, we need to do something and we don't know what that something is. So let's start here. So I started with human rights organizing. And it wasn't until my senior year of college where I got involved with climate because for a while I was studying public health. And so I was like, I want to do an internship that's like adjacent to public health and like that impacts public health, but isn't just like a public health internship. And so I ended up doing a clean energy and climate internship. And that really changed, like, it changed how I viewed it. And I think I was kind of lucky because I kind of came in from the clean energy perspective, which is really, it's really strong on like the economy and workers' rights and all these things that like make our society better in a multitude of ways. And so I think it's really dovetailed with the human rights work. You know, we know workers' rights are intrinsically involved with the climate and our economy. And so being able to like to speak to all three of those, I think is really important. It's helped me get into this work.
Yeah, well, clearly I can pick up your passion for your avocation. And I'm grateful for that. I've been a supporter of Amnesty International over the years. I mean, by decades. And when you said, well, our parents, mm-hmm. I guess I would go into that category. And so Amnesty International, I can see that the human rights aspect really does have a link in with what we're facing with climate. And we're going to jump into that here in a little bit. I know you're with Citizens for Healthy Bay. That's also an organization that I've been a strong supporter of for the last few years. So tell us a little bit about Citizens for Healthy Bay's mission. What Citizens for Healthy Bay do?
Yeah, so we were started back in 1990 as kind of like as like a volunteer group, really, that was coming together, recognizing that, you know, Commencement Bay had been polluted and really disregarded in a lot of decision making for decades, right? You know, whether it's from OxyChem, right, those chemical manufacturer, to the Asarco plant, which was a little bit up near Point Reston, but, you know, was spewing toxins into the air for miles and miles. And so I think there's just a really strong need. You know, Commencement Bay has several toxic sites and Superfund sites, some which are, you know, mostly cleaned, some of which are partially cleaned. And so I think there was just a real need for the folks back then to come together around how do we keep this water clean? Like, you know, Commencement Bay is such a beautiful, not only is it an asset, right, but it also has the intrinsic value of nature. And so that was how CHB started back in the day. We have since evolved some of our programmatic work to do, we now do Environmental Justice Camp for Girls that my coworker Khadija leads on. She's a clean water educator. I work on our climate program. And so we do a lot of climate work now around how do we get the Tacoma Tide Flats to be like as low carbon and regenerative as possible, right? Recognizing that like we're a really important economic engine in Tacoma and that's great, but we need to be making sure that we're also doing what we need to do, right? Which is protecting workers' health, reducing our emissions, making sure that we're not just polluting these waters that, like, you know, lots of frontline folks depend on, and obviously the Puyallup tribe and the Muckleshoot people depend on these waters. And so, you know, we started around water conservation advocacy, and that's kind of our bread and butter, but we've expanded into like to climate work too, because we know that, you know, as sea level rises, as the ocean acidifies, that's going to impact Commencement Bay extremely hard.
Yeah. So, what are you specifically up to right now? What's on your agenda? What's on your plate right now? What's going on?
Yeah. There's a lot. You know, we have our regular programmatic work that is like our Bay Patrol and we're the only non-government entity that has a boat that's able to like go out and look for stuff like pollution and dumping and things like that. So that's a really important function of ours. My programmatic work and some of our work that is more stuff I lead is around our climate program, like I mentioned. So the big one right now, we're in the middle of the interim regulations or the non-interim regulations. Basically, that's just a fancy way to say tide flats protections. Back in 2017, the city council passed, you know, a step in the right direction by limiting new industries from setting up shop in Tacoma. We do have several fossil fuel facilities, several that are over 1 million gallons, which is a lot of fossil fuel. And some of those are much bigger than that. So that stops new ones from setting up shop, right? Which is great, right? We don't need new fossil fuel facilities coming into Tacoma. We need to be transitioning away from that. There's this big, unfortunate loophole. And maybe some folks would say it wasn't a loophole, is that the current industries can expand. And they have some big permits that they've been issued by the state. And local clean air agencies. And so there's this really big disconnect between, you know, we do want to start making that transition because we know that we have to get our emissions, the bulk of our emissions down by 2030, right? We have to do a lot of that work now. There's real incongruence with that and the fact that the current industries are kind of grandfathered in and have kind of free reins to expand as long as they kind of check the box. And so that's been a real, real struggle for the community. And it's been something that we've been mobilizing around for almost four plus years. And I think it also hits a really sensitive spot. You know, the community really, really mobilized very, very aggressively in 2016 to prevent the methanol facility from popping up. And right after that was defeated, we immediately had the LNG facility be permitted, kind of in the cover of night. A lot of folks felt like, obviously there was like a government process, but it felt very sudden. And so I think we're also grappling with like a lot of community hurt and mistrust. And so this has been a real mobilizing opportunity to show our elected leaders, like, you know, we're thinking about these things, right? Like we don't want to relegate, you know, a lot of these workers who might not have access to like secondary or tertiary education. We don't want to relegate them to these dirty industries. We want to make sure that we have room to grow into clean industry. So that tide flats regulation is a big fight we're going through right now. And we have a hearing today. And hopefully we'll get those passed in May. And then it's on to this other process called the subarea plan, which we could jump into, but I've been talking a lot.
No, that's why you're here, is to talk a lot. So I'm just curious, this is kind of a technical question about the LNG facility. So how is it that they're grandfathered? I mean, this seems like a new facility to me. So what am I missing?
Yeah, so it was basically permitted right near that cutoff. So it was permitted. The permit application, to my knowledge, went through before that was passed. And so even though it had a lot of procedural hurdles to jump through and it wasn't even built and all this stuff, it's now built, obviously. It was grandfathered in just because of the timing. Similar things have happened with like giant retailers and other things like that, right? Where we decide that we want better land use. And so the folks who want to take advantage of that are like, well, I guess I got 3 weeks to apply, right? And so it's one of those situations where it was just really unfortunate timing.
Yeah. So then the problem becomes, if I understand what you told me correctly, that over time, those guys, they've got their stake in the ground and the interim regulations and regulations further downstream are really not going to apply to them. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think that's why we try to talk about this being a first step, because these interim regulations are not the end all be all, right? We have an LNG facility that's going through enormous legal battles and at every level of government for the last several years, and it's not being heard by the courts. Some environmental groups like Earth Justice, along with the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, is going to court. And there's some procedural stuff that's happening now. I'm not a legal expert, so I try not to say things that aren't accurate. And so, yeah, these are like step one, but you know, we have so much more to go. You know, we still are going to have possibly an operational LNG facility sometime soon if that's not struck down. And, you know, we still have a lot of land use decisions that we've been kicking the can on. You know, luckily the state legislature passed some stuff around like growth. There's a budget provision for the Growth Management Act. But this is really only step one. We have so many more fights. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we want to kind of get past this one, right, is we want to make sure that we're not expanding anymore, so we can now have the conversation around like, okay, now that we're not expanding, how do we decrease, right? Because there's a lot of different numbers floating around, but we have a couple years, right? We have about a decade to get the most of our emissions down, and then we can start doing that long term visioning work. But we have to start that, you know, today. We should have started it right decades ago. So we're overdue.
Yeah, it's like that Chinese proverb about the best time to plant a tree, 20 years ago. So 2030 shows up a lot in talking about our climate future. And one of the reasons I believe what's going on in the tide flats is so important is that if we put in infrastructure down there now, they're going to be wanting to use that infrastructure for 30, mm-hmm. 40, 50 years. And so that kind of underscores the importance of the work that you and others are taking on. So I did have one other question for you about the tide flats. I was looking at a map of the tide flats the other day, and the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, about at least approximately half of the tide flats are part of their reservation. I mean, so where do they fit in this discussion about what's happening on their reservation?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we have to like first start from like this understanding that, you know, indigenous folks have been on this land or their traditional lands, you know, since time immemorial. And they have been stewards of the land in a way that Western colonial civilizations just haven't been. And so like, that's something we have to start from. But yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, there's ancestral lands of the Puyallup folks. There's the tribal reservation, right, which is much narrower. And yeah, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians has land in the tide flats. And they have, you know, treaty rights that go back from the 1800s that, you know, that allow them to have access to the flora and fauna of this land, because it's part of their cultural first foods. And so, you know, there's the issues of like the actual land itself. And then there's also this larger issue of the implications of our industries that pollute the water so that they're not able to harvest shellfish as much as they would like to. And they're not able to use the water in the same way that they did thousands of years ago when they built their tradition and their customs. And so, you know, I'm not an Indigenous person, but I am a person of color. And so I feel, and I think we all should, we should all feel this. Like, I feel a real duty to make sure that like my actions are aligning with how they would like to be treated and take, and how they would like to take care of this earth. And so land use decisions are a huge, huge impact to Indigenous folks. And something you'll hear a lot of Indigenous people say, is that like, you know, when the climate crisis gets worse, like in their worldview, they can't just leave this land. It's not like they can just leave, you know, the ancestral burial grounds and all of these places where they raise their families. Like, I think to us, it's, it would be unfortunate to leave, right? Our homeland, but right, we might have houses, we might have family, but I think to us, it's not as scary because it's kind of common, right? But for a lot of Indigenous communities, you, you know, you stay near or on your land because that's part of your faith and your belief system. And so that's a huge issue too, is like, you know, as sea levels rise and as things destabilize, you know, folks don't have a lot of resources. And so I think that's always a part of the equation too. And, you know, and the LNG facility is near or on Puyallup tribal land, right? And that was definitely not a policy decision that they made. That was the city of Tacoma. And now there's a lot of consternation around it. And it's on people like us, like activists, to try to do the work to make sure that we are serving our neighbors whose land this is on.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're getting into this whole area of climate justice and equity, which, mm-hmm. If I understand correctly, that's a focal point for you and your work. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So my official title is a climate justice community organizer with Citizens for Healthy Bay. I'm also a volunteer with the Sunrise Movement, which is a movement that's supporting the creation of millions of good jobs in the face of the climate crisis through like a Green New Deal and a federal jobs guarantee. And so, you know, centering the communities most impacted by the climate crisis, I think, is the only solution forward. But we also have to recognize that we can use the chance of rebuilding our economy to be low carbon to also make sure that we're taking care of, like, you know, right, making sure folks have sick leave and, you know, paternal and maternal pay and things like that. And so like we kind of believe, we believe it's important to like restructure our entire society and economy to be low carbon, but also to be equitable and to take care of the communities that we haven't for generations, because we've been so afraid to have conversations around race and class. Luckily that's not the case anymore, right? Where I think a lot of us are freed from that kind of box that maybe some of our elders were put in, you know, generations ago. And so I think that's why I feel really happy and lucky to be in this moment too, is because we have the ability to speak truth to power in a way that folks before us didn't have, because it was like, it was a risk to their job, to their family, to their faith. And now we can just be honest, and people expect that of us. And so I think that's really, really empowering.
Well, I appreciate your, let's say, positive approach to that. You used the term the box. I mean, I, from a white middle class person perspective, you know, I'm in the process of getting my arms wrapped around the box and the difficulties, you know, things can seem subtle, but can be powerful. And the barriers to communication and the barriers to understanding, you know, they're tough, tough subjects. And I do see what you're talking about is that at least we're getting to the place where we're kind of willing to take them on. Because when I was a kid growing up, it was sort of like, yeah, everything's fine. What are you worried about? You know, some people do good, some people do bad. It's got nothing to do with you. And to start evolving into a place where we all bear responsibility for each other and creating a clean and healthy environment. So I am pleased to hear you finding opportunities to speak truth to power, as you say, that may not have been true 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So, yeah, good to hear. So the legislative session just closed down, and any thoughts on how things went with the legislature this session?
Yeah, there was a lot happening. And so, I was blessed to be, I'd say, a little bit removed from the legislative session, although that's not that true, because I am the policy co-lead for Sunrise Tacoma. My policy lead, the person who is our lead, her name's Mariana, she is really close to all that legislative work. through her day job. So we were plugged in, and there was a lot of good ideas. There was a lot of good stuff. You know, I think we were disheartened to see some big policies around the Growth Management Act not make it to full bills. Like I mentioned, there are some budget provisions in there to do some work, but we were disappointed. We had some consternation about the Climate Commitment Act. You know, I believe a price on carbon is a solution forward, but that's very nuanced, right? And there's a lot of frontline groups that were very upset, and I share their upsetness with how that process went. So, you know, I'd say I'm feeling really hopeful. Kind of take my CHB hat off here when I'm talking about the legislative stuff, because we don't quite engage, but we just don't have the capacity, to be honest. But I'm really happy to see, you know, the police reform bills. We got some good climate stuff. I think the clean fuel standard was way overdue, and so that's very promising. You know, our transit emissions are, I think, the largest block of emissions if you combine like personal, public, all that stuff, private. And so, you know, we've made some good progress, but we do know that there's a long road ahead. And you know, there's more fights too, right? Some of the bills have the process of rulemaking, right, where they have to go to like a state agency, and there has to be these panels on the rules and how they get rolled out. So we definitely can't rest, but it is nice to kind of have the space to get back into that really local work that we know is really important, right? Because sometimes our national, federal, statewide politics is kind of depressing. And so it's always nice to know that we have the agency to really engage our, you know, our city and our county and our commissions and all that stuff around work that directly impacts our communities.
Yeah, you mentioned a price on carbon, which is something near and dear to my heart. One of the things that I think is a problem for activists in particular, policymakers, is that price on carbon tends to get lumped together, and it's not one size fits all. I mean, there are so many nuances to a price on carbon that make a difference. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
you know, I'm just hoping. Of course, I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby, and one of our focuses is putting a national price on carbon with the States, of course, are hampered because they can't control what crosses the border from one state to the other. So if farmers or manufacturers have to pay a fee within a state, then they may just move to a neighboring state, or they may lose business in the neighboring state, and so on. So it's a big subject, but I just wanted to toss out to folks who are listening in, try and avoid what I would call a instinctive response to the concept of a price on carbon. Take close looks at what the specific proposals are, because the devil truly is in the details with carbon pricing. So enough on that.
Yeah, as with all things, especially federal, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So does CHB, Citizen for Relvy Bay, so you're a Sunrise activist too. Does CHB collaborate with other environmental kinds of organizations around the South Sound?
Yeah. And so so CHB, we host, and we've had other folks at the helm. Luckily, like, we had WEC that had leadership in it, and some other folks, but we operate this coalition called the Protect the Tacoma Tide Flats Coalition, and that's a coalition of like Washington Environmental Council, Sunrise Tacoma, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, 350 Tacoma. I'm going to forget some folks, so I'm going to keep going until I run out. Earth Ministry, Sierra Club, Washington State. And so we have a lot of folks at that table that are really our boots on the ground and help us really get the word out. You know, I think we're in a great turnout for our hearing tonight, and that's because of a lot of these folks who are spending their time and really investing in the South Sound. And, you know, some of these groups are statewide, some of them are Seattle based, but they all show up to take our lead because, you know, I live in Tacoma, I'm in Hilltop. We know that things have to change in Tacoma. And so it's been really great to see a lot of folks showing up with us, you know, arm in arm, hand in hand. So that's a lot of the groups we work with. We also have partnerships with we have partnerships with the city for certain contracts. We're also supporting the Climate Justice Action Plan process, which is basically like an environmental action plan, but making sure that it's climate justice focused. And so with that, we've been really blessed to be supporting that work. And we have actually like a 10-person group of environmental justice leaders who are folks from all walks of life. Some of them are activists. Some of them are just folks from, you know, everyday life who are weighing in on that plan to make sure it centers community. So we've been really blessed to team up with a lot of awesome folks. We also work in partnership with the Tacoma Urban League to do our environmental justice camp for girls. Where we have a camp that's centered around women of color and getting them, showing them that like being in STEM and being in science is like a viable path for them. Cause I think a lot of young women, especially young women of color, aren't shown that they don't see themselves reflected in certain industries, right? And STEM is one of those. Obviously it's changing over the last decade or so, and we're getting to a better spot, but that's a big program of ours. And then, you know, of course, we always try to be as close to the Puyallup tribe as we can, recognizing that like we're on their land as settlers. And we owe them a lot as folks who've taken care of this land since time immemorial. And so we have some programmatic work with them as well. And so those are most of the groups that we try to partner with. And we'll partner with anybody too. You know, we try to have amenable relationships with folks in the tide flats and other areas so that we can at least have conversations around what moves us forward as well.
So the parent organization, if that's the correct term that you mentioned initially with all the various environmental groups, what's the name of that?
Yeah, that's the Protect the Tacoma Tide Flats Coalition.
Okay. So I was unaware of that. So I learned something every interview that I do. So I appreciate that. And you also mentioned a climate justice group that, does that group, of course, probably right now you're meeting on Zoom if you meet, is that right?
Yeah, so the Environmental Justice Leaders Work Group, as a component of the Climate Justice Plan with the city, they meet on Zoom. They meet once a month. They have some stuff that they do in the interim, but they meet once a month to review their values and their vision for the plan because the city's trying to give a lot more agency to community this time around. Right, recognizing that, like, if you keep engaging the same folks who are either like, you know, government professionals or business leaders or activists, we're only going to get so many perspectives, and we need more. And so that group is meeting once a month virtually, you know, because of the pandemic, and they're doing really good work. But it's always hard when it's behind a screen. You know, I think so much of organizing is around the interpersonal relationships and the friendships you get to build with folks, and like, right, showing up to their bridal showers and all these things and supporting them in the full breadth of life. And so we obviously don't have that right now, but it has been really heartening to see folks time after time show up, even with concepts they don't know and with issues that they might be really sensitive, and just really putting the best foot forward, right, on behalf of the city, right? And the city, you know, like, I have a lot of respect for people that work at the city, but I think there is a lot of mistrust with every community in government right now. And so it's really beautiful seeing these folks kind of put that aside because they know that like the perfect can't be the enemy of the better.
Yeah, absolutely. So you made reference, and I hadn't thought about this, to what we could call the folks on the tide flats, i.e. the businesses there and the people whose jobs are there. So what's your sense in terms of CHB's relationship with those kinds of organizations? Are they open to what you have to say, or are you guys considered the opposition?
Yeah, I'd definitely say it's very nuanced. You know, there's a lot of players, right? There's a lot of competing voices, right? We have governments, like there's some governments right over there that have jurisdiction of the lands, and then there's the businesses, and then there's advocacy groups or like public agencies, that might like lobby. But I'd say, so we have some good relationships with some of the industries like Schnitzer Steel. And we have some good relationships with labor folks. And we really try to leverage, you know, those conversational relationships. And like, we recognize we're not going to have the same priorities, right? Where CHB is a nonprofit, we're a C3. A lot of these are businesses. And so like, we're not going to have the same priorities, but like we can hold space and have conversation. And like, that's a start. Right. So I'd say, you know, not quite oppositional for most relationships. You know, it's, you know, it's also hard to tell who's operating in good faith and bad faith, but the relationships that we have, we really value. And folks have been really good to us. Some of the people in the Tide Flats will show up to our charity events or our galas, you know. And so we think we have a pretty functional relationship. You know, it is hard, though, I think, when a lot of times stakeholders have to kind of fill in for government in a lot of ways, because I think government sometimes is very reflexive and it's not always like a strong long-term vision. So we kind of have to fill in the gaps. And I think that's where we kind of butt heads, because, right, we can't make decisions around business, right? We don't have the capacity, and business can't make decisions around environment other than like what's in their supply chain. So I think that, right, there's that consternation, but I think we're getting to a better spot. And I've been with CHB for a year and a half. And I think in the year and a half, I've seen a lot of growth happen among those conversations.
Yeah, awesome. So as we finish up here, anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to put forward?
That's a great question. There's always so much I can pull from. I guess for folks listening, I always encourage them to like follow their passions when it comes to advocacy work. You know, I think for a long time, especially on climate, folks kind of felt like they had to be like a biologist, or they had to be only advocating for the polar bears, right? Or strictly for conservation, because that's like the apolitical version of environmentalism. And I'd say like follow what makes your heart happy. We all have to be going kind of full speed in every direction. And so I always encourage people, you know, it seems scarier when you're on the outside, but like, you know, that's why groups like us, like we make toolkits and talking points, and we have the city council link there for you so that you don't have to feel afraid, right? Like we already have to fear the climate crisis. We don't have to fear, making our voice heard, you know, right? It's not helpful at that point. So I'd always say just follow your passions. Always feel free to reach out. You know, we want to be a support mechanism for y'all. And you know, I always say give them hell. we feel really helpless a lot of times, and I've committed to not feel that way anymore, because it's not helpful for me. And so I encourage other folks, if they feel passionate about this conversation or some of the things they've heard, you know, take whatever baton you can grab and run with it.
Yeah, so really, really important insights that you offer there. One of the things that back in the day, there was the expression, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. And, you know, with the idea there being that, you know, you don't have to be an expert. All you have to do is bring your passion to work. And, you know, the knowledge comes over time. So I think your summary message there is really a valuable, maybe the most important message that we could give to folks who are concerned, but they haven't taken that first step yet. So I got to say, Marquise, I really admire your passion for your subject. I mean, it comes through big time. I also admire your depth of knowledge about so many different aspects of what you're doing. And on behalf of the folks that love this country that we live in, I thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thank you for everybody listening. You know, always remember that, right, our tax dollars mean government works for us. The money we spend on businesses means they have to keep our future in heart, and that we have the ability to speak truth to power, and we should use that ability. So thank you.
Okay, awesome. Have a great day, Marquise.
All right, take care, John.
Well, thanks and appreciation to Marquise Mason for taking the time during this busy season, what with the Tide Flats, the LNG, City Council, County Council, important decisions being made, legislative issues, and so on. So grateful for Marquise's time with us. And I believe he's representative of millions of young voices around the world who are speaking out regarding their concerns about climate change and climate justice. So I'll have some show notes. You can find those at ccltacoma.org. I'll have a link there for Citizens for Healthy Bay. I do encourage you to check it out. And while you're there, you might as well check out Citizens Climate Lobby. I think it's a great organization. You might find something of value there. So speaking of which, on May 22, North End of Tacoma, in person, going to be having a Climate 411 class for people who are COVID inoculated. this is not going to be your grandmother's climate change class. Yeah, we'll touch on science, we'll touch on the deniers and myth makers and the conspiracists, but we're going to be focusing on where we are, why we aren't doing better, how we can do better, what we can do to overcome some of the political, social, and cultural challenges that we face. You can find information on the Climate 411 course, once again, by going to ccltacoma.org. And I'd love to hear from you via email, John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. So that's it for today, reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.